Congressman Bob McEwen has become a great friend, he and his wife Liz, and I tell you, this man is amazing, the grasp that he has on capitalism versus socialism. I've had him share many times on politics, easy as pie. It's one of the best things I've ever heard in my life. And he's going to bring clarity to this. For, you know, many young people today think that socialism is just fine. It's because they don't know what they're talking about. They don't know what socialism is. And I can promise you that Congressman Bob McEwen will be a blessing to you as he shares his insights on capitalism versus socialism.
Have you ever wondered what socialism really means? What free enterprise really means? Well, my name's Bob McEwen, and I'm just really delighted to be a part of this Biblical Worldview series. And the thing that we're going to talk about today is socialism. And once you understand it, once you see it, you can never forget how it works. And that is, why are some nations rich and some nations are poor? Why some people are rich, why some people are poor? And I'm going to give you the answer that just so many people just do not know how it works. And so in the process, let's just start with the fact that America is a nation that's very, very wealthy. Now, why? Well, have you ever understood about a farmer when he has a milking stool? And a milking stool has three legs on it. You know, if you take one of those legs away, the thing doesn't work. And as you'll see in this series, this Biblical Worldview series, that is that a biblical worldview of spiritual righteousness is essential. Now, once you have the spiritual values, then you have to have economic values. That's what we're going to talk about today, socialism and free enterprise. And then you have to have political freedom. And so if you have spiritual freedom, economic freedom, and political freedom, then you have what is we've been able to enjoy for 200 years in America. And that's our goal. And it has to be preserved. Otherwise, it can be stolen at any moment. I use the example of economic freedom. A little five-year-old says to his mother, "I'm fed up with this place. I'm out of here." He grabs his teddy bear, storms out of the house, and the mother goes over and stands behind the curtain and watches. He's not going anyplace because he has no economic freedom. Now, if he said, "Oh, by the way, I stole your credit cards and took $500 and storms out the door," then it's a different situation. So in order to be free, you have to have economic freedom. Otherwise, he'd be as tied to that house as if he were tethered. And so part of freedom is that part. Another part is political. You know, you can be a millionaire, but if you're in jail, you don't have any political freedom, then you're not really free. And then we know that people have money and they have political freedom, live in a great country, but yet they're not spiritually free. And so they have various addictions or their relationships do not work well. And sometimes even they end up taking their life because they do not have spiritual freedom. So all three of them are intertwined. They all three are necessary for liberty. And then what we're going to talk about here is the economic part and what is socialism. Now, socialism is government control of the tools of production. You say, "Well, I've heard that." And what does that mean, the tools of production? The tools of production are the things that are necessary for us to, as we're going to learn in a little bit later, in order for us to make money, we have to do something good for someone, and the tools are what allow us to do more. If I cut down a tree with a hatchet, I can't cut down as many as I can with a saw, and I can't cut down as many as with a power saw. So the tools make a difference, and if government controls the tools, then I'm at the mercy of them, and that's what socialism is government control of the tools. Now, a lot of places, people don't like rich people. And we're going to find out why that is in just a moment. But let's just take a notice about America and why Andrew Womack and why those that care about our nation want to focus on this and why it's important for you to understand so that you can tell others as well. 4% of the people on this planet wake up every morning and call themselves Americans. And yet every year they write more books, more plays, more symphonies, more copyrights, inventions than the other 96% combined. You know, no nation has blessed the world like this nation has blessed the world. Only 4%, and yet it gives 5.5 times as much to global evangelism, the furtherance of the gospel, as the entire rest of the world combined. This is the place that people look to for hope. When a ship is attacked on the high seas, as happens over 300 times a year, to whom can those people turn? The standard for righteousness in the world, which is America. They know that America will treat them fairly. They know that America, if they're on a yacht, in the Caribbean, or if they were that tanker from the British that were in the Straits of Hormuz and attacked by the Iranians, the only place that they could call for help was the American 327,000 Americans wearing the uniform of the United States Navy. The list goes on, and that's why we want to make sure that we can't have that stolen out from under us, primarily not even by people who don't like America, but people don't know what they're doing when they're voting to destroy those things. You know, the second richest spot on earth is Western Europe, France, Germany, Britain. In America, we have a level below which we will not permit a person to sink. You come to this country, sit down on a park bench, gripe and complain about the country, we will bury you with stamps for food, a roof over your head, a bed to sleep in, unlimited health care for you and anybody you know, education for you and your family. A person who lives in poverty in America. Now, this is done every 2 years by the Wall Street Journal and the Heritage Foundation. It's called a Rector Study. Robert Rector has been doing it for 30 years. He takes the gross domestic product, the goods and services that are produced by every nation on earth, and he puts them all in a row. A person living in poverty in America is more likely to have a telephone, a television, an air conditioner, an automobile, eats more meat, has more square footage space to live in than the average resident of the second richest spot on earth, which is Western Europe. And of course, it's significantly downhill from there for most of the world. So how is it that this nation is able to do that? We say, well, Bob, not everybody in America is rich. I know that. But in comparison, you take Arkansas, which if we want to talk about poverty, we could take black and white film and go down and picture somebody sitting on their porch in the Ozarks, and we say, isn't this terrible? Well, a person, let's take the state of Arkansas. The gross domestic product, that's GDP, the goods domestically produced, all of the work that's done in that state, the GDP of that state is larger than the sixth largest nation on earth. Pakistan has over 200 million people. And yet, all the goods and services from the entire is less than the people in Arkansas live on. 3.5 million Oklahomans produce more wealth than 91 million Filipinos every year. The list goes on and on. The entire 140 million Mexicans, fewer than the state of Illinois. Now, why is that? Why is that that when you go to the Rio Grande and you cross the Rio Grande, on one side you have beautiful homes and swimming pools and country clubs, and on the other side, you have such abject poverty? It's important for us to understand what that is, and economics is the answer, and free enterprise versus socialism is the choice. And so what is socialism? As we said, socialism is the control of the tools of production. You and I cannot go into business in Mexico. If we want to go into the pipeline business, or we want to go into the grocery business, or we want to go into the trucking business, we can't do that. Why? Because government controls that. And this is why in socialist countries, people hate rich people. And we're going to find out in our country, we honor people who are successful because we know something that if you know this, you're qualified to serve in Congress or any position of leadership. Most people in America do not know why some people are rich, but also they don't understand how they get money. And in free enterprise and socialism, it's entirely different. So under socialism, you get money because the government gives you the right to engage in business. And therefore, poor people don't respect rich people in those countries because they know they got a special deal. We were leaving it was a congressional delegation. We were walking out of the embassy in Jakarta, Indonesia. And the ambassador shouted just before he left, he said, now be careful about people that are standing along the side of the highway for seemingly no reason. He said, they'll throw rocks at people in American cars. And the question would be, why is that? Well, here's why. Because an American car is expensive. And who would be able to afford an expensive car in a socialist country like Indonesia? Well, it would be someone who had a relationship with the government, and the poor have no way of becoming rich. Therefore, they hate the rich. And that's why America is so different, and that's why we need to understand how a person gets rich. So let's talk about that. Socialism versus free enterprise. Let's say there's a car going down the road out here, And there are only two ways that I can get money out of that person's car. There's only two ways that I can get that person to give me money. One is called free enterprise. And free enterprise is where I lay awake nights figuring out ways to do something good for that person, such that they'll slam on their brakes and they'll pull in the driveway and say, oh, you're going to wash my car and sweep out the carpeting and wash the windows and the dashboard. I'd much rather have that than have this $10 bill. Oh, a pair of shoes, I'd much rather have that than have this $60. A global position, a GPS unit. Why, I'll never get lost again. I'd much rather have this than have the $200. And so under free enterprise, we figure out ways how to do something good for the person such that they voluntarily, freely reach in their pocket and make an exchange, which at the end of the exchange, they are both better off. They are wealthier than they were before. They have created wealth. And if they're not better off, they don't make the exchange. So let's get it again. Let's say a farmer has a stack of wheat, and there's a baker, and he has 10 empty ovens. And he says, if I had his wheat, I could make flour and donuts in the morning and sell them to the people on the way to work. And the farmer says, I don't need all this wheat. If I had that baker's money, I could put a new roof on a barn and buy a new tractor. And so the two of them come together and they make an exchange, which at the end of the exchange, they are both better off. They have created wealth. And by the way, this is the only way that wealth is created. When they voluntarily make an exchange that they are wealthier than they were before. Now the farmer says, I have more wealth than I had before. I have a better deal. I can take this money and hire this fellow over here, and he can help me farm this additional 400 acres. And therefore, they can create jobs and continue to create wealth. That is called free enterprise. Now, I said there are two ways to get money out of that car going down the road. The other one is called socialism. That is, I just come up to the car and I take it. Now, if we do that without government permission, we call that person a criminal. And let's say that the car is stopped and a fellow puts a gun in the window and says, I want 50% of everything in her purse. Now, question, has he created any wealth? No. Has he redistributed wealth? Yes, from her to him. But the degree to which he has benefited is the degree to which she's diminished, and so no wealth has been created. Therefore, can a criminal create a job? No, he can't, because he hasn't produced anything. He hasn't created anything. He's only taken what somebody else had. Here's the point. Let's not call him a criminal. Let's call him a councilman or a congressman. And they come along and they take the money away from the person. Now, when they do that, have they created any wealth? No. Have they redistributed wealth? Yes, from the person that produced it to the person they want to give it to. And that does a couple of things that are not so handy. That is, it discourages the person that produced it, and it rewards the person that didn't earn it, and therefore the whole system begins to fall apart. Because the people that produce don't like to have it stolen, and the people are getting it for nothing, they say, why should I work? And so the people that do that use this word. They talk about wealth distribution, the way that wealth is distributed. You'll hear Bernie Sanders always talks about it. You'll hear the mayor of New York always talking about how there's plenty of wealth in this country. It's the way it's distributed is the problem. And he wants to come and redistribute wealth. Well, under socialism, that's where the government comes in and redistributes wealth that people have produced from the people that haven't, give it to people that didn't. The people that produced no longer can produce, and so the country becomes poorer. We've seen that in Cuba. We've seen it in Venezuela. We see it in New York City. We see it in Chicago. We see it in Los Angeles. The degree to which we have more and more socialism is the degree to which there is increased poverty. And so as we get into that, let's take a couple of keys, first of all. What is money? And are we interested in money? You know, some people say, well, I'm really not interested in money. Let me explain to you what money is. Money is a representation of a contribution that I've made to someone else. Wow, that didn't make much sense. Say it again. Okay, money represents something I did for someone else. So let's say we go into the shoe store And there's a nice pair of shoes there for $80. And you tell the store clerk, you say, I'd like to have those shoes. And he basically says this. He said, what have you ever done for anyone that would entitle you to have those shoes? He says, well, I have this. Well, what is that? It's a $20 bill. Well, where did you get it? Well, I got it because I mowed Widow Johnson's yard, and Widow Johnson gave me this $20. It is a representation of the contribution that I made. Store owner said, well, that's good. That's nice. That's a good start. But it took 2 hours to make these shoes. You mowed her lawn in just 20 minutes. So you go back and mow the lawn for her a few more times. You get some more money. You contribute more. You have the representation that proves that you did it, and then you can buy more things. Therefore, a person who has money under free enterprise has performed a good or a service for the person such that they voluntarily reached in their pocket, gave them the money, and the more contribution they made, the more blessing they are to the people, the more money they receive. Therefore, under free enterprise, we honor people who are successful because we know that the way that they got the money was because they did good things for people. Under socialism, it's because they had power. And so you'll notice that when people are talking of socialism, they always want to focus on skin color or on gender or on tribe or some other group because they want to take power, not because of what they've done for someone under free enterprise, but because they're able to elect themselves to power to take it because of the group that they belong to. And that's where all of this ties in together as to the spiritual character. That when America was founded, it was founded upon the biblical principle that we are equal in God's eyes. And the further you get away from the cross, the further you get from the recognition that God made us, then the more tribal the people become, and then the group wants to have power, and that's where socialism comes into play. So in order to have free economics, in order to have free liberty, we also have a spiritual value system. So under free enterprise, the way that I get money is by doing good things for people. But I would like to sometimes increase my contribution to be able to do more for people because a person is rewarded, here's the principle, the greater the contribution, the greater the reward. The more you can do for a person, the greater the return. And so that's why in America, only 4% of the population of the world has more Nobel Prize winners than the rest of the world combined, has all these inventions. Let's take, for example, an app. Now, a vast majority of the apps for the internet or for your cell phone are made in America. Now, why is it the other 96% don't do it? Well, I reminded of a story of a time I was walking out the door, and my son said to me, he said, Dad, do you have that app that shows what gate you're coming in at the airport and what gate you're going out? And I said, Robert, what do you mean? And he opened it up and he showed an app that you could get on your phone and you would type in the flights that you were going to take. And then as you landed at the airport, as you're taxiing, they would be able to tell you which gate you're coming in, a layout of the airport, and you could see where your next gate is. It could be across the hall or it could be in another terminal. And I said, well, that would be very helpful. How much is it? And it was 99 cents. Now, the question would be, why would a person make that? Because they didn't want me to get lost? No, they didn't care about me. Question, is it worth it 99 cents to me to put that on my phone? Yes, it is to do that. Well, the person that worked on that app that made it in the hopes that a million of us would download the app and that person would become a millionaire. So under free enterprise, you figure out ways to do things good for people such that they will purchase it because I would rather have the app than have the 99 cents. And that's what free enterprise does. Now, here's an interesting part of all that. Do I care if the app was developed by a 6'8" African-American male? Or was it made by a 5'1" Asian female? The answer is, I care not a whit. What I care about is, does it work? And under free enterprise, you're not rewarded because of who you are. You're rewarded because of what you do for others. And the greater the contribution, the greater the reward. Now, when you want to take things under socialism, where you want to take it because you have the group, then you're always dividing out. You're always talking about a person's skin color, their gender, their height, or their weight, or their something, because you get power by the group. Under free enterprise, we're all equal, and we figure out ways to do good things and to make a great contribution. Let me hit that a little bit more. So how does a person become rich under free enterprise? I remember when computers were only run by really, really smart nerds that had the little green eye shades and their pocket protectors and all, and they knew how to do that. But a fella came along and he said, I'm going to make a little picture. And it has all of this background in it. And if you just click on the picture, it'll perform it what you want done. And so I'll call it Windows. And if you just click on that window, it'll do it such that computers, rather than being extremely difficult to operate, are now little two-year-olds can operate a computer. Now, what was the principle? The greater the contribution, the greater the reward. The person that figured out how to do that became the richest person on earth because people voluntarily said, I want to have one of those. I want to be able to do that. And computers went from the back room of very large corporations to being carried around on our pockets. That's how free enterprise blesses people. Socialism doesn't reward people because of what they did. Socialism controls people. Socialism controls the tools. You have to submit to what they are doing. And if you're not satisfied, then they will control you. They will tell you whether or not you can move to a certain place because they control where the lumber goes. They will decide what outfits you can wear as in China and elsewhere. They cover your face if you're a woman or others have to wear face coverings because government tells you. Now we want to focus on how that comes about, and I want to give you this idea. That is, I want you to picture for me a chart. And we say on this chart from 0 to 100. And let's say that 100 represents 100% of the income of any city or any state or any nation. Or let's say that it represents a $100 bill. And you're going into a store, and the most expensive thing in the store is $99, and you have 100, that means you're completely free to choose anything in the store. Now let's suppose someone comes along and takes 25% of it away from you and leaves you with 75%. What happens? Well, two things happen. First of all, there are some things you can no longer choose. That means that you have less freedom. The more choices I take away from you, the less freedom you have. Thomas Jefferson said freedom is having choices. Anyone that's ever raised a teenager has had this fight about I want to make my own decisions. So as I take money away from you, you then have fewer choices, which means that you have less freedom, and you have a lower standard of living. If I take money away from you, you're worse off. Anybody would understand this unless they were with the New York Times and they might not see it. But let us suppose someone comes along and takes half of your money. What happens? Even fewer choices. Even a lower standard of living. Suppose someone comes along and takes 75, leaves you with 25. Your taxes are, that would be in New York, where much of the taxes would be three-fourths of your income and property and state and federal and else would be three-fourths of it would go to government and you're left with only 25. Now let us suppose that someone comes along and takes it all. What do we call that person who works all day and keeps absolutely nothing? That person is called a slave. Now, only two people, as we've learned, only two people can take money away from you. One is a criminal, has a gun, and can take money away from you. And the other is called the government, has a gun, and can take money away from you. But here's the point. And whenever you go to vote, this is what you need to always remember. The impact is the same, whether it's taken from you by government or by a criminal. That is, you go to the pay window and you pick up your paycheck and you walk across the parking lot. A fellow comes up, puts a gun in your ribs and says, I want half of everything that you've got. You go home, we sit with your wife and children. This is how much money we have for food, clothing, and shelter, the kind of vacation we can make, the kind of car we can drive. Or you make it all the way to your pickup truck and you open up the paycheck and you see that half of the money is already gone. That is, Uncle Sam's already been here. The impact is the same. And so here's the principle. The greater the freedom, the more you're allowed to keep, the greater the freedom, the greater the wealth in a country. The greater the government, the cost of burden of government, the greater the poverty. And it only works this way every time. You can make any rich place poor, or you can make any poor place rich. When I was in the state legislature in Ohio as a member of the Ohio legislature, Ohio was number one in new job creation. We created more jobs than any other state in the union. And yet we elected a governor who said, we can put a stop to this. And so as they began to increase taxes and the burden and regulations, and of course they're always saying, we're going to tax that guy, we're going to tax that fellow over there. As they did it, it began that people couldn't make a success there. That is where you're running a business. And the burden, the cost of running it, you have to pay for the gas and for the heat and the overhead and the workers to come and all. If government keeps coming and taking more and more and more, you find out that you can't increase the price of your product. The people want to buy it, and so you go out of business. And when you do that by increased government burden, you create unemployment and you create poverty. And Ohio went from number one in new job creation to number 49. If you understand this principle, you can make any rich place poor, or you can make any poor place rich. It's just the kind of people that we elected. When Margaret Thatcher became the Prime Minister of Britain, the socialists had been in control, and they'd increased the burden of government so heavily that the country was literally falling apart. And so there was garbage in the streets, and the International Monetary Fund took control of the British pound sterling. That is, they couldn't even back their own currency. They were in such distress. Margaret Thatcher came in. She reduced the burden of government. She cut taxes. People began to save and invest and produce more, create new jobs and things, such that by the time that she left, it was the fourth largest economy in the world. If you understand that, you can make any rich place poor, or any poor place rich. When I was young, the richest city in the world, was a place called Detroit, Michigan. And at the same time as that, one of the poorest spots in the world was South Korea. It was third from the bottom. Well, we elected a mayor in Detroit who began to focus on race. He began to appoint people based upon their skin color, fire people based upon their skin color. He began to tax people that were successful, such that when people came through town or they went into business there, he took so much money that they couldn't survive. And so now Detroit, the richest city in the world, is now the poorest city north of the Rio Grande River. And what happens when you come up and people take what you have? You leave. And so the population of Detroit is now as low as it was in 1900. We've lost over 100 years of growth. That city has become poor. South Korea, at the same time in the 1950s, was third from the bottom. But they got freedom after the Korean War, and the Americans showed them how to have free enterprise. And Korea is now the 10th richest nation on earth. It has the 10th largest GDP. Now, North Korea is the same heritage, the same climate, the same culture, the same language as South Korea, but North Korea got socialism. It is a socialist country, and so it's abject poverty. In fact, over the last decade, 10% of the population of North Korea starved. And that's, as you know, the first thing you do is food, clothing, and shelter. They can't even do the food part. They eat sticks and they walk bent over and things. South Korea, the 10th largest, richest nation on earth, because they got freedom. Freedom creates wealth, and socialism creates poverty. So the question then is, how do I increase my contribution? How do I do more for other people? Well, one of the best ways that I can do that is to go into business. And that is that I think of ways that I can help other people. And by doing that, I bring people along and I show them how we can bless. And here's the key ingredient to free enterprise. There is no government planning board deciding where and what people should do, and there is no need for one. Because the consumer, that's you and I, we voluntarily vote with our dollars every day to reward those who give us a sandwich that we like, that give us the kind of car that we want, the kind of windows that we prefer. We reward those people, and therefore they prosper. So that there is no government planning board to tell them what to do, because we daily decide who is going to produce goods in what quantity and in what quality. And the greater the freedom, the greater the reward. And so as we conclude this session, we've discussed how the socialism doesn't work. Why is it that some countries are in the condition they are, and yet people are trying to sell that idea to us now? Now, in a few more sessions, I'm going to come back, and we're going to tell you why socialism never works. But right now, let's just remind ourselves, before we go down this road, that after World War II, Stalin wanted to take communism and socialism, as you know, the USSR, the Soviet Union, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. And that was the idea that government could tell you what to do, and that was so much better than allowing people just to wander around and decide whether or not they were going to produce corn or whether or not they were going to produce wheat, that government should make those decisions for. And it sounded so noble, particularly in college campuses, and they told people that this would really be a good thing. And yet, when after 40 years of that, and when the wall came down between the East and the West, and we could see on the other side that all of these great, wonderful people, the people in Poland and in Romania and Bulgaria and Ukraine and all of these wonderful, Czechoslovakia, all these great, talented folks couldn't make a single hairdryer, a TV set, an automobile, made nothing that people would voluntarily buy on the open market. Communist Yugoslavia, they made this thing called a Yugo. And the Yugo was just an absolute piece of junk that when they got freedom and people could choose voluntarily, reach in their pocket and decide what they could get, the Yugo was gone overnight. So in discussing what we've seen is that socialism doesn't work, but the next step that what we'll want to talk about is that why socialism simply cannot work. And no matter how noble it sounds, that you should always watch for the words that those people use, like they want to talk about redistribution. And you and I know that if you were to drive from Ohio to drive west to Colorado, you'd go, maybe go through Iowa, and on both sides of the road, you would see corn, as far as you could see, corn. Then you get to Nebraska, and you see wheat on either side, wheat, mile after mile. And then you get to Colorado or Utah and you see cattle in open fields. And you can imagine these socialists would stand up and say, "You elect me president. It's terrible the way that wheat is distributed in this country. It's terrible the way that corn is distributed in this country." Well, every farmer would look at him like a cow looking at a new gate. And that is, corn's not distributed. Wheat is not distributed. Wheat is grown. Corn is grown. And free enterprise allows us to create wealth. Wealth is not distributed. Wealth is created. And we're going to talk about how that wealth is created and why is it that the free nations can produce it and the socialist nations can only redistribute what somebody else made. And so until then, this is Bob McEwen, and a privilege to be a part of this biblical worldview effort.
Socialism, it's when government owns everything.
Under communism, there is no business owners, there is no private section.
The government calls the shots. And that's just the next step to communism, where free trade and privatization is no longer acceptable.
They destroyed ownership and they owned everything. So the people, they start to understand that if you want to have anything, you need to take from someone. So if you have one and I have one, if I want to have two, I want to take yours.
Private enterprises were not allowed at all. So if you try to like sell something, you know, buy it somewhere for cheaper and sell it for some more expensive price on the market, you could get in trouble for that. So and the police can come and arrest you and jail you for that.
We had this massive department store that was privately owned, and then the government took over that store and named it Guyana Stores. So everything was nationalized, in other words. So there was no private industry. There was none. That's when I was a kid. I didn't know of any private industry.
You weren't allowed to have any private enterprise. So opportunities for entrepreneurs, there were none. There were none where we lived. During the time frame that I was there, it was not allowed. In fact, people were too busy just trying to survive. I think that there's no time to dream.
Until this day, I have a hard time dreaming or envisioning something. It's just so oppressing. There's no such freedom of mind, even like to imagine how much you're capable of. In the Soviet times, you're not capable of anything.
I think what happens in a communist country is they get you, they try to limit people to their income to such an extent where all they can think about is survival. Most of their money often goes towards the necessities.
Thinking about where to find the food, clothes, and just to feed your family.
The living situation in Russia was very bad. People were crowded.
In Russia, it would be like two, three generations living together.
A family would often live, most commonly live with parents, children, grandchildren, and great-grandparents all in one house just to save money.
Back in Ukraine, the quality of life was not something that was important to the government. So there was really, you couldn't, we didn't have luxuries. There was nothing that you could even afford as a luxury. They were just the necessities. You focused on getting what you needed, not the things you wanted.
The housing that government could give you, which is apartment, and it's around 126 square feet. It's really small, and if you don't like it, you don't have any choice. Because government decided for you, that's what's needed for you.
In Russia, apartments are very small, and even now, in some apartments, there are several generations, I believe like it can be three generations of people who lives in the same apartment at the same time. And it's like not thousands of square feet of apartment, it's like on a 500 or 600 square feet. And it was like just one bathroom. It doesn't matter, like you can have like three or four bedrooms, but just one bathroom.
We had outdoor toilets. You had to go outside to use the bathroom. I was used to having water being cut off, electricity being cut off. It was kind of the norm. You just learned to live with it.
Utilities is under control. So if they want in the middle of the winter turn off and do the maintenance, they will turn off utilities and turn off the heat and turn off the hot water and do the maintenance.
And also in Soviet Union, government tells you what kind of quality of product they're gonna produce. And usually, because it's for free, usually it's very bad quality. It doesn't last long.
A lot of products were in deficit. And so when you go there, you need to stay in line, huge lines. And again, the products were very bad quality. So, and you need to stay in line, I don't know, for toilet paper, for sausages, for bread, for milk, for sour cream, for everything.
If there's ever meat or if there was ever butter, things that are in short supply, flour, there was usually a lineup.
You go to the store and, you know, you see a line, big line of people, and they don't even know what's out there. It could be just a kilogram, which is 2 pounds of bones, just to make soup out of it. If you go to, you know, a regular day, you'll find maybe lard laying on the shelf. That was about it.
There was no food. There was a deficit of everything. You couldn't buy clothing. You couldn't buy food. I still remember getting up at 4 or 5 in the morning in the middle of winter, and we would stand in the snow outside on the street just to get one loaf of bread each.
Food shortages was the norm. Even basic necessities you couldn't get, like things that we even produced in our own country, like rice and sugar. It was rationed. People would go to the stores and the shelves would be empty, and you took your list and they said, okay, I can only give you a gallon of whatever, a pint of rice or 2 pints of rice, so you had to make do with what you had. The food shortages was bad, and the water cut off, and the electricity cut off, and having to adjust to all of that. But I think the main thing was, food shortages. It was huge. It was huge.
People could not feed their kids, so a lot of government could still support like institutions like orphanages, and lots of people actually brought kids into the orphanage just to have kids to be fed, And that's how people struggled so much. There was, you know, food stamps. You have 10 food stamps. Food, for example, they say you will come this week to get your food. And you have like 10 food stamps for a whole week. But that doesn't mean that they have enough food for you.
It was a common occurrence to see empty shelves and everything is still under lock. And there would be one or two things standing on the shelf. And there's a huge line of people waiting. So you stand in line and you stand and wait for half an hour. And by the time you get to your place in line, those two things on the shelf are gone and you can't even buy anything. So that was common.
We hope you've been blessed by watching this teaching of a biblical worldview on socialism. Biblical Worldview is brought to you by Andrew Womack Ministries and Charis Bible College.
Hello, this is Andrew Womack, and I want to invite you to come and sit under the Word of God 4 hours a day, 5 days a week for 2 or 3 years. I promise you, it would transform your life. You know, God has put it on my heart to make disciples, and the best way I have of doing that is through our Charis Bible College. We not only have our main campus in Woodland Park, Colorado, but we have campuses scattered all over the world. You can go to our website to get information on it, but I promise you, this is a deal changer. Many of you know there's more and you just don't know how to get there. Come and let us help you discover who you are in Christ and who He is in you. It'll change your life.